Hi, I'm Trip Gulick from Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City. We're going to talk about HIV/AIDS in 2025. I have no disclosures. I am the current co-chair of the DHHS Adult and Adolescent Antiretroviral Treatment Guidelines Panel, and I will be referring to the guidelines in this talk. The current estimate for the ID boards is that about 15% of the content is HIV related. And you can see the breakdown here. Small bits on epidemiology, pathogenesis, and lab testing, more consideration for HIV treatment regimens and opportunistic infections, and then less on HIV related malignancies, other complications, and related issues. We're going to cover many of these topics during this talk. The first cases of AIDS were described in the CDC Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, MMWR, all the way back in 1981. And you can see the title here, Pneumocystis pneumonia from Los Angeles. In the period October 80 to May 1981, five young men, all active homosexuals, were treated for biopsy-confirmed pneumocystis pneumonia. Now, what was unusual about this report was not pneumocystis, that had been described before, but only in severely immunocompromised people. We now know that this report is of the first five cases of AIDS described on the planet. Latest estimates are that over 88 million people have been infected with HIV since the beginning of the pandemic, and about half of them have died. Here are the US numbers last updated in 2022 from the CDC. And what we're looking at here are AIDS diagnoses shown in blue, AIDS deaths shown in green, and the prevalence of people living with AIDS shown in yellow. So as you can see, AIDS came out of nowhere and then increased to its highest levels in the mid-1990s. And along with that, again shown in green, are AIDS-related deaths, which peaked in 94 and 95. And then you see a tremendous decrease, two-thirds decrease within 2 years of both AIDS and deaths. And since the late 1990s, continued decreases. Why was that? Well, of course, it's the development of effective treatment for HIV, antiretroviral therapy. As people don't die from AIDS, they live with HIV infection, and that's what's shown in yellow. And you can see that the number of people currently living with an HIV/AIDS diagnosis, so including AIDS, is over 500,000 people in the United States. Current estimates of those living with HIV in the United States are about 1.1 million. Here's the breakdown in terms of risk groups for new infections with HIV or HIV incidence. And you can see age-wise, we're talking about young adults. So the bulk of new infections is in people between the ages of 20 and 40. Although worth pointing out that 10% are occurring in people up to the age of 50 and over. In terms of gender, men are overrepresented, about two-thirds of the cases or even more in men compared with women. In terms of areas of the country, the bulk of infections occur in HIV high prevalence areas, although you'll see cases occurring in medium low, and even low prevalence areas as well. In terms of race and ethnicity, Blacks and Hispanics are overrepresented in terms of new HIV infections compared with the general population. And you can see that reflected in these statistics. And then in terms of risk behaviors, men who have sex with men account for the majority of new infections, continue to account for them here in the United States. Although you can see that people who use injection drugs and heterosexual men and women also acquire HIV, although at lower rates. Here's the causative agent. HIV is, as you know, human immunodeficiency virus. It was first called HTLV-3, human T-cell leukemia virus, but that name was quickly abandoned as it was realized that this is not a T-cell leukemia virus. It was first discovered in 1983, and two groups are given co-credit for the discovery: a French group who received the Nobel Prize and an American group. HIV is a human retrovirus with the structure as shown in the diagram here. It has an outer glycoprotein coat, and that encases this triangular structure, the capsid, which is an inner protein coat. And inside that is the genetic material of the virus, of course, in the form of viral RNA, two strands of it. The major type of HIV is HIV-1. That's the most common on the planet by far. A related virus, although distinct, is HIV-2, and that's found in West Africa or countries with classical ties to West Africa, including Spain, Portugal, and parts of India. People may be infected with both viruses. The subtypes of HIV, also known as clades, go by letters of the alphabet, and clade B is the most common here in the US and all of North America, also Europe and Australia. Other parts of the world, including Africa and Asia, have diverse clades of HIV. HIV is an example of a zoonosis, of course, a disease that initially was in animals and then jumped to people. This infection occurred in primates and likely made the jump to people around the turn of the last century. And this is based on lots of data, which is now scientifically accepted. The target cell of HIV is the CD4 positive T lymphocyte, or what our patients call the T cells. And as you know, T cells play, or CD4 cells, play a key role in coordinating all of the responses of the immune system. Okay, question number one. What is the current sequence of initial and confirmatory HIV diagnostic testing? Is it ELISA followed by Western blot, ELISA followed by HIV RNA, ELISA followed by immunoassay, HIV RNA followed by Western blot, HIV RNA followed by ELISA, or HIV RNA followed by immunoassay? So pick one of these choices. The correct answer is C, ELISA followed by immunoassay. The old sequence was A, ELISA followed by Western blot, but this was abandoned several years ago because of the cost of the Western blot and the timing of positivity, which is longer than newer assays. So currently an ELISA followed by the immunoassay. HIV testing is an important part of the ID boards, and today we certainly can test indirectly for HIV using HIV antibody testing that you're familiar with. We test for HIV 1 and 2 antibodies by the ELISA test, and if it's repeatedly positive, you go to the confirmatory test. As just mentioned today, that's an immunoblot. In resource-poor settings, they may use rapid tests and use an initial rapid test, and then as a confirmatory test, a different kind of rapid test. And that is considered in international settings proof of HIV antibody positivity. We now have oral tests, which can be done in much shorter times, as few as 20 minutes, and even a 1-minute blood test is available. We can also test for the virus directly. Antibody testing is obviously an indirect way to do it. We can test for the P24 antigen. We can grow the virus in culture, although that's a research tool. And then, as you know, commonly we can do a quantitative or qualitative test for HIV RNA, which we call the viral load test. Contemporary test is the combination of the HIV antibody and the P24 antigen test. This is the so-called next generation test. And this decreases the window period, that is the time from infection to a positive detection test, which used to be about 3 months, but now is as little as 2 weeks. Here is the algorithm from the CDC, now over 10 years old. So using this combination antigen antibody immunoassay that tests for both HIV 1, 2. So that's the initial test. If someone's negative for that, so negative for antibodies and P24 antigen, we say, congratulations, you're HIV negative with high certainty. And let's talk about ways to keep you negative. That is HIV prevention. If someone's positive on the initial combination test, then they need the confirmatory test. And as mentioned, that's the immunoassay. These use specific antibodies to detect HIV-1 and HIV-2. And you can see the scenarios here. So if they're positive for one, that would be the most common in a positive person. Then they have HIV-1 antibodies detected. The next group, rarer, HIV-2 antibodies detected alone without HIV-1. As mentioned, someone could be positive for both. And then the trickiest one is the fourth group here. So they were positive on the initial test, but the confirmatory test, they're either negative or indeterminate. And what the algorithm says in that case is then you go to a nucleic acid test like the HIV RNA test. If they are negative for that test, then you have just diagnosed a false positive reaction based on the very first immunoassay. That's often entails a lengthy conversation with the patient to understand all of this, but they have not been confirmed with HIV infection. If you find here that someone is lacking antibodies on the immunoassay, but is positive for HIV RNA, then you have just diagnosed acute HIV infection. This is the first test that turns positive. Sometimes the question comes up about low positives, and be wary of low positive HIV RNA. Less than 100, possibly less than several hundred, 500 or 1,000 is likely to be a false positive HIV RNA test. So someone with acute HIV infection typically has hundreds of thousands or even millions of copies of HIV RNA. And that's a testable point. So here is a diagram showing when the tests are positive in someone who's acquired infection. So someone's negative at time zero and then acquires HIV. Here's the window period. So all tests would be negative, but about 2 weeks, the viral RNA becomes the first detectable test for HIV infection. You can see that's followed several days later by the P24 antigen. And then after about 3 weeks, the ELISA antibody tests now becoming positive. Takes about 4 weeks for Western blots to become positive. And again, that's why they've been largely abandoned from the sequence of events. In fact, if you see Western blot on a test question, that's going to be the wrong answer. So disregard. Question two, who should not be routinely offered HIV testing? Is it A, a 32-year-old pregnant woman in a stable relationship, B, a 23-year-old sexually active monogamous gay man, C, a 75-year-old former injection drug user, D, a 10-year-old prepubescent girl, or E, all of them should be routinely offered HIV testing? Go ahead and vote. The correct answer is D, a 10-year-old prepubescent girl. And routinely, this person is not at risk for HIV infection and should not be offered testing. Testing should be offered to all of the other scenarios seen here. And in fact, that reflects U.S. Preventative Services Task Force recommendations published now more than 10 years ago in Annals of Internal Medicine. These formal recommendations say screen adolescents and adults age 15 to 65 for HIV infection. And you may know that geriatrics groups recommend testing at higher ages. Screen all pregnant women. And then, as commented, younger adolescents and older adults who are at increased risk should also be screened. This is a grade A recommendation in the guidelines, meaning that there is a high certainty that net benefit is substantial. And what that means from the federal rule is that private insurance and Medicare must offer these services without a copay. So this is generally available to all of our patients. What about transmission of HIV? This table shows HIV transmission risks, and we're looking at different exposure risks from someone with HIV, and how often does that exposure result in transmission of the virus. So blood transfusion from someone with HIV to someone not with HIV results in transmission 9 out of 10 times, or over 90%. Someone with HIV who shares a needle through injection drug use with someone without HIV transmits about 1 in 167 times. But of course, people who use needles for drug use often use multiple times per day or per week, increasing that risk. Percutaneous needle stick from someone with HIV to a healthcare worker, for example, results in transmission about 1 in 500 times in the absence of any kind of preventative treatment. And then there's sex. So among sexual practices, receptive anal sex. So someone who is HIV negative receiving anal sex from someone with HIV results in transmission 1 in 70 times. Insertive anal sex. So someone without HIV inserting the penis into the anus of someone with HIV, that will result in transmission to the insertive partner 1 in 1,000 times. Receptive penile vaginal sex, 1 in 1,250. Insertive penile vaginal sex, 1 in 2,500. Oral sex thought not to be an important risk of HIV transmission, hard to quantitate, hard to find people who only participate in oral sex, but this is thought to be very low or even zero. And then mother to child transmission. So infected mother to her child results in transmission without prophylaxis or prevention 1 in 4, or about 25% of the time. All of these statistics really are in the absence of the use of any kind of preventative, which of course we have today. Here's the time course of HIV infection in an infected person. So someone is negative and then becomes exposed to HIV. And this is a complicated diagram, but let me break it down for you. In green is viremia, so measuring HIV RNA in the blood. And you can see right after infection, people reach very high levels. The highest I ever saw was 13 million copies of HIV RNA per milliliter of blood. And you can imagine that is a time when people readily transmit the virus to other people. That number will go down in the setting of acute infection, but be detectable in the absence of treatment throughout infection. And then in late stage infection may reach high levels once again. In blue are the CD4 T cell counts in blood. And as you know, a normal T cell count is above about 450 cells per microliter of blood. This number will go down in acute infection, sometimes can go down below 200 and leave the person susceptible to opportunistic infections, but most times will not do that. Then will rebound, and in the absence of treatment over the course of years will decline. When the peripheral CD4 cell count hits 200, we now recognize profound immunodeficiency, and they fulfill the CDC criteria for AIDS. CD4 cells can continue to decline. The lowest one I've ever seen was 0 cells per microliter of blood. In purple is mucosal CD4 T cells. Most of these are in the intestinal associated lymph tissue. Again, someone starts out with a normal amount of mucosal T cells. Those drop rapidly by about 80% within weeks of acute HIV infection, and in the absence of treatment, never increase over the course of the illness. And finally, in red is immune activation. So HIV is a potent activator of often negative kinds of immune reactions, and that can take place throughout the course of untreated infection. That leads to inflammation and can result in end organ damage. The time course of this from infection to AIDS on average in the United States is about 10 years, and untreated AIDS infection to death is about 2 years, again, in the absence of treatment. So here is the CDC adult AIDS case definition. Back in 1982, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, that term was first coined. Obviously, a syndrome is a list of signs and symptoms where you don't know what the underlying cause is. And you might say, why do we still use that term? We know this is a viral infection, but it turns out that name just stuck. So in 1982, this was a list of diseases with a definitive diagnosis that showed immune compromise, and then disqualifying conditions like other reasons for immune compromise, such as cancer, chemotherapy, autoimmune diseases, et cetera. In 1985, the HIV antibody test was developed and was added to the definition. So for AIDS, you needed to have an AIDS-defining illness as well as have antibody positivity. In 1987, several other diagnoses were added to the list, including, importantly, tuberculosis. And in 1993, which is the current definition, having an HIV antibody test positive and a CD4 less than 200, regardless of symptoms, now fulfills the CDC criteria for AIDS. Opportunistic infection. What's the definition? This is an infection caused by an organism that's capable of causing disease only in a host whose resistance is lowered, that is, has immune compromise, either from other diseases like cancer or by drugs such as cancer chemotherapy, and as we know, or steroid therapy, and AIDS qualifies as one of these diseases. AIDS-related opportunistic infections, some examples are shown for you here. So bacterial, we see atypical mycobacterium like MAC infection, Mycobacterium avium complex, or MTB tuberculosis. Fungal diseases such as pneumocystis, pneumonia, also known as PJP, cryptococcal disease, and histoplasmosis. Viral infections such as cytomegalovirus or CMV, parasitic infections like toxoplasmosis, and then AIDS-related malignancies like Kaposi's sarcoma and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. All of these are considered to be AIDS-defining illnesses. These occur depending on the level of immune suppression. So the CD4 cell count, and that's what's shown for you here, often guides us in what opportunistic infections may occur. In people with CD4s above 200, they have some degree of immune competence. You will see the more aggressive pathogens that can cause disease, again, in the absence of treatment. So herpes zoster, candidal thrush, leukoplakia caused by EBV, or routine bacterial pneumonias and tuberculosis. Those are the HIV-related diseases that are seen at CD4s above 200. And of course, they can be seen at any stage of infection. As mentioned, clinical AIDS occurs at 200. Below 200 is where pneumocystis occurs, only rarely in the 200 to 300 CD4 range, so most cases below that. When the CD4 drops below 100, that's when toxoplasmosis and cryptococcal disease occur most frequently. And then MAC and CMV, relatively less potent pathogens, occur only at CD4 counts under 50. So CD4 can guide us in the possibilities of opportunistic infections. Much of what we've talked about so far has been in the absence of antiretroviral therapy, but of course, today we have it. And what's the goal? The goal with ART is to suppress the HIV RNA, the viral load level, as low as possible for as long as possible. If we can suppress the viral load, we can preserve or even enhance immune function, which we typically monitor with the CD4 cell count, and people on ART can return to normal CD4 cell counts. And ultimately, with restoration of immune function, our aim is to delay clinical progression of HIV disease and prolong healthy survival. When should you start ART? There are two sets of guidelines we consult in the United States. The DHHS guidelines, I mentioned before, I'm the academic co-chair. These are updated routinely, and here's the website here if you want to see the latest recommendations. And the other leading brand is the International Antiviral Society, USA guidelines. These are updated every other year and published in JAMA. They were just updated at the beginning of 2025. If you wanted one paper that's about 15 to 20 pages long that discusses all of HIV treatment and prevention, that's the reference to go for. So what do the guidelines say about starting ART? Anyone with AIDS or symptomatic HIV disease or asymptomatic disease, now regardless of CD4 cell count, should be treated. So I can simplify this slide and just say, treat everyone with HIV, regardless of symptoms, signs, viral load, or CD4 cell count. Of course, when the patient is ready is important. So the current DHHS guidelines say ART is recommended for all persons with HIV to decrease morbidity and mortality, and importantly, to prevent transmission of HIV to others. So a person with HIV and a suppressed viral load does not transmit HIV. The guidelines say initiate ART immediately or as soon as possible after diagnosis, and of course, when the patient is ready. Well, once we've decided to start, we need to decide what to start. As this diagram shows, there are 35 drugs that have been approved for the treatment of HIV infection. They're portrayed here by their three-letter codes, and you can see the timeline. So the first antiretroviral drug to be approved was AZT, azithromycin, also known as zidovudine. And then you can see every year, one, two, three, or even four drugs have been approved all the way to 2022. And since then, we have not had a new drug approved. So altogether, 35 HIV drugs are available. How do they work? Antiretroviral drugs block or inhibit the life cycle of HIV, which is shown for you here. So here's the virus, here's HIV again, outer coating, inner capsid coating, encasing the RNA. HIV recognizes and binds to the CD4 cell by binding to the CD4 receptor, which is sitting on the surface of the cell. When that binding occurs, it induces a conformational change and allows binding to a second cellular receptor called the co-receptor, either CCR5 most commonly, or in late stage infection, CXCR4. When both of those receptors have been bound, that allows fusion of the viral membrane with the host cell membrane, and the contents of the viral particle are now extruded into the cytoplasm of the cell. While this is happening, HIV reverse transcriptase, so a viral-specific enzyme, does the opposite of nature and transcribes viral RNA into viral DNA. This is occurring as the HIV capsid particle is being transported into the nucleus of the cell. The capsid, the orange structure here, uncoats and releases viral DNA now into the nucleus of the cell, along with viral specific enzymes, one of which is HIV integrase. So HIV integrase takes the viral DNA and inserts it into the host cell DNA. Once this occurs, the CD4 cell is infected for life, and this can be present now in the system for 50 or 60 years or even longer. And that's the challenge for HIV cure. Once you have the viral genes integrated into the host cell genes, we don't have a current way to extract that viral DNA. And at any point, the cell may be activated, the viral DNA transcribed into viral proteins and used to make additional copies of viral RNA, which assemble at the surface of the cell and then bud off into new viral particles. The last stage of the life cycle of HIV is maturation of long precursor proteins by the viral specific enzyme HIV protease. And that's required for full maturation and infectiousness of these particles. When enough of the viral particles have budded off from the cell, the integrity of the cell membrane is lost and the cell dies. And when enough CD4 cells die, the immune system becomes compromised and people get sick. So the whole approach to treating HIV is to throw up roadblocks in this life cycle. The first drugs we had inhibited HIV reverse transcriptase, so they're called the reverse transcriptase inhibitors. They either look like the DNA bases, so they're nucleoside analogs, or they don't, and those are non-nucleoside analogs, binding to a separate part of the enzyme. The next class of drugs targeted that very last step. These are the HIV protease inhibitors, at the time, the most potent drugs yet discovered. But drug development went on. HIV fusion inhibitors inhibit that early step in the life cycle. That's one of three steps of HIV entry. We also have chemokine receptor inhibitors or co-receptor inhibitors and CD4 attachment inhibitors. Next developed were the HIV integrase inhibitors, which have become the cornerstone of therapy today. And the last class to be approved were the HIV capsid inhibitors, which target not only capsid uncoding, but also capsid reassembly. So a whole host of mechanisms of action for antiretroviral therapy. Here are the 35 drugs, this time shown for you by mechanistic class. So the column on the left are the reverse transcriptase inhibitors, the nucleosides on the top listed with their generic names and three-letter codes, and down below the non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors or NNRTIs. In the middle up top are the HIV protease inhibitors, and on the bottom, the HIV integrase inhibitors. And then over to the right are the many types of HIV entry inhibitors and the first HIV capsid inhibitor. Now, if you counted these up, you might say, whoa, you missed a couple. And it's true, there are not 35 drugs listed here. In fact, as you can see below, seven of the original 35 have been discontinued from the market. Why? Because they were either too toxic or too inconvenient or less potent than drugs we have today. Antiretroviral activity is shown for you here. Back in the 80s, when we had one drug, we used it. What we're looking at here is change in viral load level on a log scale. So AZT by itself reduced viral load levels about 90%, almost a log, but these quickly rebounded. And if you looked at viruses here, they were now resistant to AZT. In the mid-1990s, we had two nucleosides and we used them. What you saw was a more profound decrease in viral load level, about 99%, but not completely, but then again rebound. And now some of the viruses that rebound were resistant to both drugs. In the late 1990s, with the advent of HIV protease inhibitors, we first used three-drug therapy, and we saw something different. So you decreased viral load levels, and importantly, they did not rebound. You were effectively suppressing HIV replication and preventing the development of resistant virus. This is 6 months of data. We now know you can suppress HIV with drugs for decades. Question three, what class of ART is recommended for initial HIV treatment for most patients? Is it A, all nucleoside regimens, B, NNRTI-based regimens, C, protease inhibitor-based regimens, D, integrase inhibitor-based regimens, or is it E, entry inhibitor-based regimens? Go ahead and vote. The correct answer is integrase inhibitor-based regimens, and that's based on their potency, convenience, and tolerability. So here are the current DHHS guidelines for what to start, recommended regimens, and they all have the same structure, one or two nucleoside analogs together with an integrase inhibitor. And the specific regimens are bictegravir, TAF or tenofovir alafenamide, and emtricitabine FTC. And the slashes here tell you that this is a co-formulation. So one pill once a day with three drugs in the pill. Dolutegravir is the other integrase inhibitor that is currently recommended in guidelines, combined with two nucleoside analogs. So FTC is emtricitabine or lamivudine, together with one of the two formulations of TAF, either formulations of tenofovir, either TAF, the newer one, or TDF, disoproxil fumarate, the older one. Note the inclusion of a two-drug regimen of dolutegravir and 3TC. This should not be used in people with viral loads over the level of 500,000 copies per mil. People with hepatitis B, because only 3TC is active against hepatitis B and would quickly develop resistance, or if you don't have the results of resistance testing. And then a newer consideration are for people who use the other integrase inhibitor, cabotegravir, for PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, that may have selected integrase inhibitor resistance, and you would want to change and use a protease inhibitor-based regimen, and the protease that is recommended is darunavir, based on tolerability and potency, boosted with either the drug cobicistat or the drug ritonavir, and then with two nucleosides. So these are the current recommended regimens, and again, readily testable. Alternative regimens include the nucleoside analog abacavir, which has fallen from favor due both to a hypersensitivity reaction that can occur, as well as a link to cardiovascular disease. And then this is where non-nucleoside and protease inhibitor-based regimens, which used to be recommended but are now alternative. And again, why did they drop down on the list? Typically because of potency, tolerability, or convenience. There are a number of one-pill, once-a-day regimens that we use today. Many are shown for you here. The first back in 2006 with Tunix and efavirenz. You can see now that we have one pill once a day with other non-nucleosides like rilpivirine. We have them with integrase inhibitors, a number of them listed here. And even there's a one pill once a day protease inhibitor combination. And as mentioned, a two drug, dolutegravir and 3TC. A newer drug on the scene is cabotegravir, as I already mentioned. It is an integrase inhibitor that's similar to dolutegravir and is potent against HIV. But the excitement about this compound is that it's nanotechnology formulation. It is one of the first injectable antiretroviral drugs. Phase 3 studies of an all-injectable regimen, these are intramuscular cabotegravir with the non-nucleoside rilpivirine, so a two-drug injectable regimen, showed non-inferiority to standard oral treatment regimens, and that led to the FDA approval of this combination. Initial approval was based on monthly injectable therapy. And specifically, this was for switch therapy. So switching from people who are undetectable on oral antiretrovirals, have no history of virologic failure, drug resistance, or hepatitis B, because neither of these drugs is active against hepatitis B. But with additional data, the label was updated to allow every other month dosing of cab rilpivirine. And that is being rolled out across the country and across the world, although it does present some logistical challenges. It's now been out long enough that this could be a subject of a board's question. Well, how are we doing overall? These are numbers from 2019 and show that of all people in the United States living with HIV, just under 90% had been diagnosed, 81% of them had been linked to care, 66% had received care, only 50% retained in care, and overall about 57% of U.S. people with HIV actually had virologic suppression on antiretroviral therapy. Well, these numbers were recently updated for 2022. Not much change in terms of diagnosis, so still 13% of U.S. people with HIV don't know they have it. Little bit higher in terms of linkage to care, and up to 65% of all people are suppressed or undetectable on antiretrovirals. So more room to go in terms of getting these numbers up. Antiviral therapy has substantially impacted HIV-related deaths. So these are deaths among people with HIV from 2010 to 2018. And the solid blue line shows the decrease overall. Interestingly, when you break it down, this is all due to decreases in HIV-related deaths shown in the blue small dotted line. So these have declined by half over this time period. You can see non-HIV-related deaths. So this includes cardiovascular disease-related and non-AIDS cancers. And that really hasn't changed over time. So increasingly, HIV-related deaths account for fewer of the diagnoses among deaths compared with standard reasons for death in this country, cardiovascular disease and cancer. Consequently, the life expectancy of someone with HIV on antiretrovirals is now approaching that of the general population. So really an enormous accomplishment. These are data to back that up. This is from a large cohort collaboration looking at people with HIV on ART for at least a year after 2015, so using contemporary regimens, at age 40 in North America and Europe, and combines two big cohorts, one from North America and one from Europe. And you can see over 200,000 people were followed during this time frame, and then just under 6,000 deaths, and they used that to model life expectancy. So what you see on the left is women, on the right is men. The general population, so a woman in North America and Europe, age 40, on average can expect to live another about 46 years, so into her middle 80s. And a man can expect to live about an additional 40 years, so into his early 80s. That's the general population. What you see here is broken down by CD4, so focus on the right-hand side. These are people with CD4s over 500, so normal levels, and they are approaching the general population. So if they've reconstituted their immune system on ART, HS is heterosexuals. You can see after 2015, very close to the general population. Injection drug users after 2015, certainly big gains, but not quite as good and not quite up to the general population. In men who have sex with men, really not different than the general population if they started antivirals after 2015 and have CD4s over 500. Heterosexuals, a little bit less. Injection drug users, gains, but not quite as good as the other groups. So this is powerful information to tell our patients with HIV. If you take your antivirals, you can expect to have a normal life expectancy. HIV prevention. So we have always had the standard ABC approach: abstain, be faithful, and use condoms, get counseled and tested. That's worked for many people, but not everyone. So we've expanded the alphabet to include a number of other strategies. Some have worked, some have not. Circumcision, so removing the male foreskin, which is loaded with CD4s, proved effective in three different studies in Africa, reducing the risk of acquiring HIV by about 60%. And that has been rolled out as a global strategy to combat HIV. D for diaphragms didn't really work. That's not been explored. Probably the most successful is E, exposure prophylaxis with ART. So initially in pregnant women to reduce transmission to their babies, and then the development of both pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP and post-exposure prophylaxis or PEP. Many of these strategies have been successful, and I'll review them in a little more detail. The rest of the alphabet, not so successful. So microbicides are substances which a woman could apply often with antiretrovirals intravaginally. Those have had mixed results. And then treating genital tract infections, or specifically herpes, have not been effective. And unfortunately, immunization with many studies have not shown an effective HIV vaccine yet, although testing continues. Question 4, which PrEP regimen is FDA approved for at-risk men and women? Is it A, daily tenofovir disoproxil fumarate, or TDF, emtricitabine, FTC? Is it B, daily tenofovir alafenamide with FTC? C, on-demand TDF-FTC? D, on-demand TAF-FTC? Or E, all of the above? Go ahead and vote. The correct answer is A, TDF-FTC given daily. That is the only regimen listed that is FDA approved for both at-risk men and women. TAF-FTC, choice B, is FDA approved for men, but not women. Neither on-demand regimen is FDA approved. However, maybe the TDF-FTC has a track record in the literature and is recommended in some guidelines. D, on-demand TAF-FTC has never been tested. So we're talking about pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP. That's the strategy of administering HIV medications to people who don't have HIV, are uninfected, but are at risk for acquiring it. The optimal drug candidates, obviously, because we're talking about a preventative, are potent, safe, tolerable, and convenient. And the one that rose to the top of the pack initially was tenofovir and FTC, one pill once a day. Clinical studies showed that TDF-FTC reduced the risk of infection, and that led to FDA approval in 2012. TAF-FTC also shown in men and some recent data in women that led to FDA approval in 2019 for men. And then more innovations. So using injectable cabotegravir for PrEP based on a randomized study that showed it was even better than oral related to adherence issues was approved in 2021. And then interesting studies, this won't be on the boards, but lenacapavir dosed by an injection every 6 months is a powerful PrEP strategy under consideration at the FDA right now. Here are some recent PrEP studies to show how effective PrEP can really be. And the thought is it's about 99% effective in people that take it. So two big studies, one from the UK, one from France and Canada. They enrolled HIV negative MSM, men who did not have HIV, randomized them to PrEP or no PrEP, and PrEP resulted in over 85% reduction in HIV. The people that acquired it had adherence issues. And then the more recent ones, HPTN is HIV Prevention Trials Network, two different studies, one in men who have sex with men and transgender women, the other in at-risk women in sub-Saharan Africa, and you can see thousands of people tested. They either got the standard of care, oral TDF-FTC daily PrEP, or CAB injections given every other month. And both studies showed that cabotegravir injections were superior to daily oral PrEP. And again, it's adherence issues that are important. Unfortunately, PrEP is not being used in all people who would benefit from it, and that's shown for you here. So CDC estimates, these are from 2021, that only 30% of people who would benefit from PrEP in the United States are actually receiving it. And you can see the group that has the most PrEP use are actually whites, and substantially fewer Latinos or Blacks are being offered and using PrEP. So a disparity remains. And then in his previous administration, our president developed the federal plan to end AIDS by 2030, which was in place. And the goal was to reduce new infections by 75% in 5 years. And this was from 2019, and 90% in 10 years. So we've already reached the first time point there. And how do you do it? Diagnose people with HIV as early as possible. Treat them and suppress their virus. For people who are at risk, who are negative, use prevention, including PrEP, respond to outbreaks, and support the HIV healthcare force to do this. Whether plans for this will continue or not is up in the air. Lastly, what about cure? There is a well-known case of HIV cure, the first cure ever achieved. This was in a person who had suppressed their HIV and was taking ART when they developed AML, leukemia, requiring a bone marrow transplant, had some complications and had to go off their antiretrovirals. You can see the viral load quickly rebounded and CD4 went down. They underwent total body irradiation, chemotherapy, had one transplant, and the oncologist had the idea to transplant from a person with a polymorphism so that it did not code for the co-receptor, for the CCR5 co-receptor, which would render them relatively immune or resistant to HIV infection. That bone marrow transplant occurred but was rejected in this patient. They underwent a second one from another person who had no coding for the CCR5 receptor. When all was said and done, off antivirals, the viral load remained undetectable and CD4s increased back to normal levels. They did substantial looks for HIV throughout this person's body and could not find it. And this person, Timothy Ray Brown, who was very out about his status, was cured of HIV infection for nearly 10 years. Unfortunately, he had a relapse of his leukemia and died several years ago. This was followed by a number of cases. In fact, we now have 9 cases of HIV cure that have been reported, including the first Latino, the first woman, which is at my own institution here in New York, the first who had a bone marrow biopsy from a wild type donor without this mutation for the CCR5 receptor, the first person who had heterozygous for this deletion of the CCR5 receptor, the first person who had rebound but then suppressed again. So we are seeing this across the world. Are we going to be rolling this out as a strategy? Well, no. As you know, bone marrow biopsy is associated with about a 30% mortality rate. But this does give added emphasis to HIV cure research. Could we do it in a safer way and apply it to more people? That's a goal for the future. In summary, what can we conclude about HIV? It is a worldwide pandemic. Routine HIV testing should be offered to all patients at least once, and those at risk should have it every year, if not more frequently. ART decreases the HIV RNA viral load, increases CD4 cell counts, prevents disease progression, and prolongs healthy survival. Current ART should be offered to everyone with HIV and consists of 2 or 3 drug therapy and is increasingly available worldwide. Current life expectancy for people with HIV who are appropriately treated approaches that of the general population. HIV prevention continues to be key, and we have newer tools, including PrEP, and cure research is in progress. And I'll just acknowledge our supporters. Thank you for your attention, and good luck for the boards.